Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your statue honoring music, news, and criticism. I'm your guest host, Karen Gantz.
You know I go insane every time you have to catch a flight. I cannot take you to the airport, make out under the bathroom lights. Put your lips on my lips, I'll remember.
We were just listening to Beg For You by Charlie XCX featuring Rina Sawayama. That's one of the singles from Charlie's latest album, Crash, which is what brings us all here today. You will notice that I am not John Caramonica, who was on book leave. I am his editor sitting in, and I am joined by Hazel Sills, an editor at NPR Music, formerly of Jezebel. Hello, Hazel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Shad D'Souza, a freelance contributor to Pitchfork, The Fader, Paper, and others, calling in from, I believe, a 15-hour time difference. Hello.
Hi.
Where are you, actually?
I'm in Melbourne, Australia.
Well, I really appreciate you, I presume, waking up early. I'm not going to do the math. But before we get super deep into present Charlie, I just want to do a very brief primer for people who might be less familiar with her. So, Charlie XCX. She is a 29-year-old English pop singer and songwriter. She's released 5 studio albums on the major label Atlantic starting in 2013 with True Romance. This latest one, Crash, came out this month, which is why we were discussing it. There was a pause between her 2014 album Sucker and 2019's Charlie, during which she put out an EP called Vroom Vroom that marked a pretty significant aesthetic shift that we are going to talk about a lot today. It carried through a couple of mixtapes she did in 2017. But in between all of that, you likely know Charlie as a very, very, very busy songwriter and collaborator. We don't have to run through her whole resume, but Iconopop's I Love It, Iggy Azalea's Fancy, Same Old Love by Selena Gomez, Senorita by Shawn Mendes and Camila Cabello. But when Charlie arrived in 2013 with her first album, did you both remember this? Because I did not. That Boom Clap, the single that preceded it, and then it ended up on the second album, was from the Fault in Our Stars soundtrack.
I unfortunately knew that.
There's clips from the film in the video.
Yes, I had forgotten about it. And then I rewatched it and was like, oh my God. So if we are going to talk about Charlie's first two albums before we get to where things started to get different, she grew up like loving pure pop, like Britney Spears and the Spice Girls. And she got on MySpace and she found the Ed Banger label. And when she started her career, she was kind of stomping around with an iPod. And an A&R saw her when she was 16 and signed her. So in 2013, we get her first EP. How would you both describe True Romance?
I would describe True Romance as a great tight album of like alternative pop music. The time in which it came out, 2013, pop music was changing significantly. The Lady Gagas and the Katy Perrys were giving way to Grimes and Lorde and Marina and the Diamonds. And I think Charlie XCX fit really comfortably in this like new alternative pop space. It was just like kind of a very cool indie pop sound. I think there were some flickers of like 80s inspiration and pulling from like electronica. It marked a new kind of direction for pop in general with that album.
It's so of the time, that album. It was produced by Ariel Rexshade, and like that was the year he made the first Haim album and Sky Ferreira's first album. I remember at the time it really felt like they were kind of three artists who were going to follow this path of maybe eventually crossing over to become huge stars, and they've all diverged in very different ways, which is really interesting. But it's so reflective of that post-peak indie moment where all the majors were kind of like doing this alternative pop star thing, which now seems kind of like the blueprint for what's happening now, but also quite removed from like, you know, they've really finessed that process now, whereas back then it felt very kind of like messy and pretty interesting, I think.
If we were going to listen to a representative track, I am always tempted to listen to Nuclear Seasons because I love that song. But I think like my secret favorite one on that one is You're the One.
You're the one who's been stealing stars. Your golden arrow went through my heart. You're the one who can turn the page. You're the one who gave me long and unlocked the cage. Now
I reckon that album slaps.
It does.
It does. I agree with you. You know what's also so great from that era was, well, maybe not exactly that year. I'm not sure what Super Love. You remember that song, obviously.
Oh, perfect. One of my top 5 of her songs, easily.
You're whiskey wasted.
I interviewed Charlie on the Sucker Cycle, which is an album that has become vaguely controversial because I think a lot of people don't like it. And she herself has stepped away from it in recent years. But I love this record because it was made in the sort of post-Avril, Ashley Simpson, Demi Lovato, like sort of pop punk girl rock mode. Did you guys have strong feelings about this record at the time?
All of your references for this album are not my references for this album. I love this album because I thought it was very like 80s new wave, almost like it felt very much like a Blondie album to me. And that's why I loved it so much. And then also lots of like cheerleader stomp, like that very 2014, 2015 millennial whoop sounds and hooks that Charlie's so good at. I really like this album. I just thought it was so perfectly of its time. And I think that I can see why people in retrospect, like looking at her career as a whole, can maybe think that it was a little bit sanded down or kind of too commercial. And, you know, it has this kind of like edgy, like leather jacket wearing, like Tumblr girl vibe that I think is kind of outdated now. But I really love this album. I think that it is just a great album. And I think that the sound of it was very retro, but also very modern at the same time.
I totally agree, actually. And before we go any further, let's just listen to Break the Rules, which was the single from the album, which I think will help elucidate some of what we're talking about.
Electric lights blow my mind, but I feel all right. Never stop, it's how we write, coming up until we die.
You know, there are definitely songs on this album that felt like she was tweaking The Clash and just sort of like nods to Blondie and things like that.
Yeah, I love those like Susie and the Banshees references and stuff. And like, it's so fun. And like, I think it's the album where she really perfected kind of like being funny and bratty. And she hasn't really had like a funny album since then. Like, there's that line on Sucker, like, oh, Luke likes your stuff. And like, there's just little one-liners like that that I think is so amazing. It really like hurts me every time she kind of like talks on that record, because I'm like, it's good. Like, it's a really good album. And like, yeah, like Need Your Love, like such an amazing kind of like camp, weird ballad. Like, I really think it was extremely, extremely underrated. I think it was kind of an important album for her. I think it really, there's a lot of kind of like anxieties about working in like the pop machine on that record that I think kind of flew a bit under the radar.
She was on a major label all this time, but she had a lot of artistic freedom. And I have to imagine some of that was because she had so much success from her songwriting that she wasn't fully dependent on the success of these albums to keep her afloat as an artist. And she was using the freedom that she accumulated by being so successful in the mainstream. But when she did this album, I didn't really have a sense that this was a stepping stone in what would turn out to be like a very vast sonic evolution between this and What Happens Next, which is the Vroom Vroom EP.
I think we can all agree that this is the moment for Charlie fans. They either stayed with her or they left her, and I stayed with her. And she comes out in, I believe, 2016 with Vroom Vroom EP. It's a 4-song EP, and it's produced almost entirely by the late great producer Sophie, who was known for her kind of insane hyper pop concoctions. Sophie was a producer who would take all the best parts of a pop song and chop it up and then sew it back together in this like crazy Frankenstein moment of a song. And so when Sophie links up with Charlie, they really kind of create this new era for her. And it's this intense, fast, metallic, electronic music inspired EP that is just working in opposition to everything she was doing on Sucker, which was like bubblegum, pink, girly. Of course, there was edge to that album, but Vroom Vroom was like, she was like making music videos in like latex dominatrix gear. And Vroom Vroom is really the turning point for the work that she would do later, working with all kinds of avant-garde electronic producers, pulling in people like A.G. Cook and the PC Music team, who were kind of based in the UK. I'm a big fan of this EP, but it was polarizing. I don't know what the Pitchfork score was, but I think it was like in the fives.
I think it was like a 4 or something. Yes, it's crazy.
All right, I'm going to have to Google it. Let's listen to the title track while we discuss it, just so everyone has a sense.
All my life, I've been-
been waiting for a good time, a good time.
Let me ride, let me ride.
All my life, I've been waiting for a good time, a good time. So let me ride.
The score was 4.5.
Damn. Cold.
Wow. Well, I have to say, I mean, I can definitely respect its artistic achievement, but this is not my favorite Charlie era myself. I think it's because I'm more of a pure pop fan.
It felt so crazy. Like, I was already a fan of Sophie and PC Music, but I think there was something they needed in Charlie to really kind of, like, unlock that kind of full potential. Because until that point, it was very, like, are they making jokes about pop music? Are they kind of like taking the piss or anything? And then Charlie gave them this kind of legitimacy that then was so important for like Sophie working with Madonna or like, you know, AG working with whoever. Like, I think it really changed the trajectory of like everyone involved's careers. I remember when the EP was released, it was so interesting. There was kind of like nothing to like grab onto in the way, like, you know, when there's like a big major label pop release, there's like heaps of features that you can read to understand the record, and there's like music videos and like promotional shoots and that kind of thing. And this was just like stark, like pretty much black on black cover art and music videos, and like compared to Sucker, it felt so wild and like exciting in a way that I think not many people have really been able to capture with an aesthetic shift. Like, even like, obviously it's a bad comparison, but someone like Taylor Swift, who changes, like, say with Reputation, that was like a pretty big aesthetic shift, but it still didn't feel as kind of like dramatic or like out of left field. Charlie is like such a Kanye devotee. Like, she's such a head, and I think Vroom Vroom was very much her kind of like post Yeezus thing. I think there was something percolating from that definitely fed into Vroom Vroom and kind of like a lot of the stuff that came after.
I'm sorry, but I'm going to force you to talk about that because I actually haven't really read a lot about Charlie talking about Kanye.
She just references him in a lot of interviews. Nowadays, she's very kind of like, I like the way she talks about it. She's like, you know, pop stars are meant to be very confrontational and not necessarily palatable, and like, she basically talks about him a lot as kind of like a real visionary and a real kind of like, you know, the same way a lot of creatives or musicians talk about him. But yeah, he's a pretty consistent reference point for her.
I kind of want to think about Charlie in terms of her major label journey, the idea that she takes all of these things that are a bit more experimental and she does them as mixtapes so that she doesn't have to push them through the major label system and get approvals. How did you feel when she returned with an album? It was 2019. So it was a fairly long break between Sucker in 2014 and Charlie in 2019. And that album definitely interpolated some of the things that had been happening on the EPs, but it also was a bit of a return to pop. Hazel, I believe you wrote about that record. You interviewed her then.
I like that album. You know, I should say that I like all of Charlie's music. At the same time, I think if you're a fan of Charlie, you recognize something that has happened in her career where she put out these really interesting, challenging mixtapes, Number One Angel, Pop 2, and they were filled with really interesting collaborators like Uffy and Abra and Cupcake and Pablo Vittar and like all of these interesting producers. And then when her self-titled album came out, it did feel a little drawn back. It felt a little like she was shaking off all of the artsy experimentation that she was doing in her mixtapes. And so I like that album, but it's hard for me to listen to it and not recognize that she's maybe not working at her full potential, which is maybe a critical thing to say. And I'm very interested to know what you two think of that album. But I think a really good example of that is like Pop 2, last track is this incredible track titled Track 10. And it's this like incredible song. And she kind of remakes it on her self-titled album with Lizzo. And it just feels a little bit lobotomized. It feels a little bit like, I don't know, like she took a really cool song and kind of defanged it in a way. But I do like that album. I think I'm more of a Charlie mixtape girl at the end of the day.
I think it's interesting, the kind of like moment between Pop 2 and Charlie is so interesting because it kind of is the start of this consistent theme in her work and like artistry, which is the kind of like fractious, intense relationship she has with her fans. So like you were talking about this moment post Sucker where like at Vroom Vroom fans either left or they stayed. And then I feel like around Pop 2, it was kind of like a big underground moment for her. Like suddenly she got all these new fans, and then Charlie comes around and they're all being like, why are you making this commercial music? And it begins this really weird back and forth with her fan base that has still caused problems for her during Crash. But in my heart, I really agree. I'm like, the songs on Charlie are not as exciting or like abrasive or like dynamic as the ones on Pop 2 or Number One Angel. But at the same time, I like love that record. And I think there's something about it that feels almost more fully formed. I mean, she's kind of said that that's one of the first times she really started writing from like personal experience very deeply rather than just kind of like writing to briefs or writing from thought experiments. I really like the mix of ravey party tracks and ballads, and it's long and unwieldy, but there's something to it that I really love.
Obviously, a lot of the sub-narrative of Charlie's career is about her relationship with pop stardom, whether or not that's something that she actually wants, if it's something that she's chasing. And I think that she very actively stepped away from that during the Vroom Vroom era up through the two mixtapes. It was a very conscious decision that the music she was making then wasn't really going to end up on the charts. But then when you come back with a self-titled album, it's sort of a signal to me of something in pop. You know, you're sort of identifying it more. Perhaps you're implying it's written more from a personal perspective. I think aesthetically, in terms of the visuals, it looked more like a traditional pop album. And the first single was the 1999 with Troye Sivan. Maybe it wasn't the first single, but that was the big single from that album, which is like a pretty, to me, vapid pop song. I don't know how you guys felt about it, but let's listen to it for a second.
I'm Anna Martin, the host of the Modern Love podcast. In every episode, we peek into an intimate corner of someone's life and learn about what love means to them.
35 years with another person. I've never spent that much time with anyone else.
So we both kind of said, I love you pretty fast.
As long as they keep the dance up, I'll keep the dance up.
And she felt the same way, an instant connection.
It's a window into how real people navigate all kinds of love. I mean, romantic, family, friendship, dog-based. They are stories of life-changing moments, small joys, big revelations.
My advice is that it's okay if it's hard.
A lot of the way that you manifest your love for your children is through cooking.
And I remember just looking at them in awe almost, like, wow, you know so much that I couldn't even dream of knowing about my brother.
You can listen to Modern Love wherever you get your podcasts.
I wasn't a huge fan of this song as representative of this era.
I didn't love this song. I do love Troye Sivan, though, but I think that it was nostalgia bait. It was just like, I'm going to make this song for young millennials who want to go back to 1999 when they were like 7 years old, 6 years old or something. But I don't think this is a good indication of what her career was at that time either. And I think the interesting thing with Charlie is like, I feel like she does want pop stardom, but I don't think she wants it in the way that most stars have to get it or how they receive it. We know that she can write a vapid hit. We've heard Fancy. We've heard I Love It. And I think 1999 is one of those songs where it just feels like it's so easy for her to just make a song like that and have it be a big hit. And yeah, it's definitely not her best work.
I also want to bring up, Hazel, something. When you interviewed her in 2019, you had this wonderful question that reads so hilariously in light of 2022, which is, you know, since you first started making music, your sound and style has changed a lot, but pop music has changed. The days of being a pop artist and singing solely about being beautiful and happy and going to parties are kind of over now. Do you recall this? And songs about depression, anxiety, like the kind you're making now, have kind of taken over. And you're curious about where that shift comes from. What a question. I mean, you're 100% right. And I'm glad you asked for that in 2019. But as a pre-pandemic question, that really leads us right into her work during the pandemic. So Charlie, she was mid making her next album, correct me if I'm wrong, and there was some sort of leak. So she scrapped everything and she made How I'm Feeling Now, which was an album she made fully in isolation that came out in May 2020, which is really hard to fathom now because we were still really in the throes of understanding what was happening to us then.
I think the weird thing with Charlie, and like it feels very like Frankenstein and very like major label, but also very like pop two sibling. And I think it really speaks to kind of like what was going on kind of behind the scenes for her at this time, which is like Charlie is kind of like the famous artist who has probably had the most leaks this side of Playboi Carti. Pretty much an entire album of half completed or completed songs was leaked between the release of Pop 2 and Charlie. And she's described it as being really traumatic and really awful for her. And like all the fans really shared it because obviously they're obsessive and like, you know, wanted all this unreleased Sophie music and unreleased demos and stuff. But it basically kind of like derailed her plan for how that chapter of her career was going to pan out. And there was going to be a third mixtape, like it was going to have three in the title. And then she would go back and do the major label thing. I think there was probably a lot of confusion for her artistically around that time. It's kind of interesting to see the pandemic as kind of maybe like a necessary reset for her, where she was kind of like, she could finally just like stop, start with a clean slate and make How I'm Feeling Now. And I think that was kind of like a crucial thing for her. Yeah, because in interviews from that time, she describes the whole leak thing as just like this awful, very dramatic event in her life.
It just seems like it's been a while since leaks have had such a strong impact on somebody's career. So were those the ones that were scrapped before she started making How I'm Feeling Now?
No. So that was music that was scrapped that was supposed to be on whatever followed Pop 2. And then she made Charlie with AG and they were like, maybe this should be the third mixtape. And then they were like, the mixtape thing is done. Like, it was ruined. Let's just do an album. And so it's, yeah, Charlie's kind of like in this weird in-between space where I think she'd been planning to make like a big budget pop record, but also hadn't kind of like scratched that itch of making these quite experimental albums.
And I think we could count How I'm Feeling Now as an experimental album, even though mm-hmm. it came out as technically an album and on Atlantic. Shad, you had written a piece about people writing about her from the perspective of calling her future pop around the time that came out.
How I'm Feeling Now is kind of her first album in the kind of like quote unquote hyperpop era, which is people labeling music like 100 Gecs, A.G. Cook, all the kind of like former PC music people. There's this new umbrella term that like teens on the internet are using to describe this genre. And How I'm Feeling Now is kind of Charlie's first album that can be seen as part of that milieu, even though she's the queen and the kind of like patron saint of that whole sound, because essentially all of that music is post-Vroom Vroom, like 100 Gecs is post-Vroom Vroom music.
I know that there's a lot of anxiety about the term hyperpop, which definitely came up, you know, in the years after those records were breaking through on Spotify. I think somebody at Spotify actually named the playlist, and that's how that came to be. But I just want to talk about how I'm Feeling Now landed and how we sort of feel it's a bridge to Crash.
It might be tangential, but it's interesting that I guess like Crash is the breakup album of the relationship that she was mending in Charlie and then working on in How I'm Feeling Now. That's a kind of like an interesting thematic arc between those three albums.
Charlie has often talked about how she doesn't necessarily want to write from so much personal experience because she wants pop music to feel universal and that the listeners will be able to apply their experience to it. But I think it would be hard to avoid tracing the relationship arc through those three albums. She said in the Zane Lowe interview, which I thought was interesting, was that Crash was initially going to be titled Sorry If I Hurt You. And it was going to be called that for a very, very long time until she decided to switch it to Crash, which did have sort of an arc between her first major label album being called True Romance and then the last one being Crash, you know, a cinematic connection there. The idea of a crash being so dramatic and disruptive, but also sort of sexy and exciting at the same time. But Crash really is the reason why we are here today. So I am now going to focus all of our energy on this album. So overall, I think this is a very strong album, but I don't think it's perfect. I think there's like four songs that are a little mid. And on an album of that many songs, how many songs are on this album? 11, 12. It takes me down a little bit. What did you guys think when you first got your hands on it?
I really like this album. I think it sort of like Sucker, it kind of ties into a lot of music that I naturally love. You know, it has this very like bombastic, dark 80s pop edge. And I know Charlie has cited Janet Jackson as an influence in the album. But like when I first heard New Shapes, all I could think about was like Freestyle Queens and like Lisa and like Lil Susie. Similarly to how I felt about her self-titled album, when I did take it in as a whole, I did sort of feel like this is not her best work. And I think that's also partly because, you know, even in the rollout to this album, it was her last album on her deal for Atlantic, which she had, you know, signed when she was a teenager. And the rollout for the album, she kept posting on social media, like images of cars on fire that with captions that said like tips for artists, sell your soul. And I just got the vibe from this album rollout, I was like, oh, this is her Endless, as in Frank Ocean's Endless, you know, the album that he made to get out of his Def Jam deal. And so it's fun pop. Like, I think it's a strong album, as you said, but I'm also like, I think she just has better work in her to come.
Interesting. Okay. I think I might like it more than you. Shad, what was your initial reaction?
I really like it. Actually, I should just come full mask off. I have a Charlie XCX tattoo.
And amazing.
Well, it was just context that like, even when she's releasing something like quote unquote mid, like I feel like I'll just listen to it enough that I'll be like, eventually be like, yeah, this rocks. Like, but it's definitely one of the Charlie projects that took me, I would say, quite a while to warm up to. I think it's just one of those things where I had to take some time to readjust and like kind of like change my expectations of what it would be. Because I think for what she's trying to do, which is this kind of like 80s, and like I love all the different reference points, like obviously Crashes, so like Jam and Lewis, Janet vibes, but then like Lightning sounds kind of like New Order, and like, you know, there's all these kind of like other things, and then like Twice is kind of like the hyperpop moment or something. Like, I really like it. I think it's got some of her strongest kind of like pure pop songwriting.
Twice, you know, like, don't love.
Love. One of my favorites.
I love Twice. And I also think maybe I'm reading into it too much, but like, I hear that song and I do think of Sophie, like, who is such a good friend to her. And like, so much of that song is about death and knowing that your friends are going to leave you and not thinking too hard about things and finding kind of the joy in life. So maybe that's me overreading the song, but I just think as an ending, it's a great track to end the album on.
All right, you might have just changed my opinion. I was interested with the meta narrative around this album where she was talking about she once again was making the big bid to be a mainstream pop star, and that she was going to take pitch songs and let that, she said, I think she put it to Zayn, she's going to let the label do their job. And she picked like the interesting moment to do that, where like, that's not actually what more avant-garde future looking pop stars are doing. Like, they're trying to get away from taking songs from A&Rs at labels. And so she, perhaps the most subversive thing for her to do would be to turn around and collaborate with the label on this record. But to me, I think that that resulted in some really good songs. I think she had said that she didn't want to take good ones because of that reason. If we were going to pick one song from this album just to listen to quickly, Shad, you just said that you think Crash is the perfect song. Is that your favorite?
Yeah, definitely my favorite.
I was going to vote for Constant Repeat.
Oh, Constant Repeat's my favorite, yeah.
Let's listen to it, and then Hazel will go off.
I could have been the one to change your life. You could have had a bad girl by your side. You could have had a bad girl, could have had a bad girl if you wanted to.
Hazel, talk about Constant Repeat.
I love Constant Repeat. It's definitely my favorite song on the album. That line where she's like, you could have had a bad girl by your side. I don't know. There's something so specific and kind of biting about that line. And, you know, so much of this album is about heartbreak. the literal crash of it, the feeling of it. And she just kind of cycles through so many emotions in that song. You know, do you think about me? But then it's like, oh, I don't care. Like, I'm better off alone or whatever. And yeah, I think it's just great. That's kind of the one that I've had on constant repeat.
Nice.
I'm being kicked off the pod.
Sorry. And that's the end of our broadcast today. When she started talking about this record before it came out, and she was, you know, talking about Janet references and things like that, I think the thing that I liked most about her looking back moments on this record is that the interpolations, they tweak what the initial song was. So, like, you know, she's using Robin S's Show Me Love on Used to Know Me and reversing the message of the Robin S song, where the Robin S song is, I need you to show me some love so I stick around. And Used to Know Me is, I'm walking away because there's absolutely no way you're going to appreciate me.
She uses the interpolations so well. Like, obviously, it's like a trope of like 2020s pop music. But yeah, like you say, she flips Show Me Love, and then like the Cry For You interpolation on Beg For You, like that song is being like, oh, I'm so in love with you. Like don't leave. Like, whereas Cry For You is like pretty straight up kind of like breakup song. Like, I think even when she's playing into these tropes of what big budget 2020s pop sounds like, she has to do it in this way that I think is much smarter and much more sophisticated, maybe.
I just think Charlie, she's just so smart. She's too smart to be a pop star. Like, even on this, but like on an album like this, like, you know, she has talked before in interviews about like really leaning into this like major label pop star performance. You know, Karen, you mentioned her like wanting to take A&R songs, like letting the label do its job. But even that, this album is not brainless. It is a good album. And she is doing really smart, twisted stuff with all of the references we've just mentioned. And I think that's the thing where it's like, there's this whole narrative about her, like, why isn't she bigger than she is? And I think it's just because, you know, even when she's doing something that's kind of retro, it's still pretty cutting edge. And I think that a lot of people aren't ready for it.
I actually talked to her last week about Crash for a feature that's coming out in a couple of weeks. And she said this really interesting thing where it's like, there's this kind of fan perception that a major label can be a hindrance, but she kind of expressed this idea that she's never felt that she's fully used the major label machine to her advantage. And so this album, she was kind of like, okay, a major label will understand if I get a video directed by Hannah Lux Davis, or they'll understand a song that's mixed by Serban Guinea, or they'll understand a song that's pitched by Max Martin's camp. And so, like, I would be interested to know whether she agreed with this idea of her being underrated, because the way she kind of puts it is very much like she hasn't really been trying to play in that world, but maybe a lot of fans and a lot of critics think that she is. And like, this is just her moment to finally be like, okay, let's use all the budgets. Let's use the cogs of the machine.
That is interesting, because the way I've always read it is that like she's been flirting with the idea of wanting to be very big, but it's also she was sort of like protecting herself from possibly not being by big by kind of like winking at it. Like, I am playing with the idea that I want to be big, but maybe I do, but maybe I don't, which would sort of make it, you know, give her a safe place to land in case something wasn't big.
I think Charlie XCX wants to be big. Does she want to make the kind of music that would facilitate that level of stardom? Because pop stars, like, they have to be everything to everyone these days. Like, they can't make albums anymore that are like worlds unto themselves. They basically have to make playlists where every song sounds different. And she's not that kind of artist. She's someone with a very specific curated vision. And I just don't think that her version of pop fits with mainstream's version of pop, or the sort of pop that's lauded by the mainstream. So I do think that she thinks she is underrated and that she should be higher rated than she is. I just think at the end of the day, like, I don't know if she wants to make the kind of music, or if she has it in her to make the kind of music that would make her a major pop star.
It feels like she could make the entire Dua Lipa record tomorrow.
Oh,
in
totally.
In eight hours and just release
in her
it.
Sleep.
And sleep. Yeah. So there is this sort of friction between, is she underrated? Is she overrated? Is she small? Is she big? And I know that sounds crazy, but Charlie has a very interesting reciprocal relationship with the press. I think we can all agree. Like, she does a lot of press. Now, we now know that we've all interviewed her over the course of the past decade. And, you know, for every album cycle, we've been able to cite a host of interviews. And she says a lot, which is great. She gives you a lot to think about. But I think that because she is a very press-friendly artist, that there is, in some sense, an idea that she is bigger than she is.
I think maybe she wants to be big, but she also doesn't. And I think it's confusing to try and taxonomize that because throughout her career, it's been like, she's been kind of like, you know, I think that sucker persona of her being kind of a rebel and kind of a brat is true to her personality, you know, because like around Sucker, she gets a number one single with Fancy. She has a top 10 single with Boom Clap. She has another top 10 with I Love It. She's kind of on the cusp of being huge, and she responds first with this quote-unquote punk album and then with this harsh noise. And then she becomes the kind of like patron saint of this sound and style that she innovated in with but doesn't necessarily see it as her main thing. And she responds to that with Crash, which is like very traditionalist. And I think it's hard to work out what she wants to do or who she wants to be, maybe simply because she doesn't like it when other people tell her what she is, which seems like a very basic statement, but I think it's something that's missed is often that she's looking to zag where everyone expects her to zig, if that makes sense. Sorry to use that awful turn of phrase.
And I also have the sense that, like, you know, she's 29 now and closing a couple of chapters. She did discuss this in the Zane Lowe interview. You know, she's about to enter a new decade. She's just closed this entire label deal. This album appears to be a breakup album, that she is perhaps on the cusp of figuring out what she really might be. I mean, like, this is the great thing about Charlie, is that, like, she's not too old, which is a terrible thing to say. People get very harsh when you're over 35. So she's not too old to reinvent herself again and have like an exceptionally long career, but she's also not so young that she's of the generation that's sort of just starting from scratch with none of this structure that she's had from having the opportunity to meet with and, you know, collaborate with these very interesting artists in addition to having the structure of the major label.
She's just had a great career so far in music, like even with the maybe hindrances of her or like maybe the limitations of her major label, she has just had like a very inside and out pop career. You know, she's been the songwriter, she's been the artist, and I'm really, really curious to see what she does next because she is out of her deal with Atlantic, and I'm really curious.
My mind is kind of blown at the flexibility that Atlantic has shown her over the years. I mean, obviously, I don't know what happened behind the scenes when she was trying to put out the albums and if she felt like she wasn't getting the sort of institutional support that you need, you know, budgets for videos, paying radio support, and things like that. But to have the flexibility to make these, I mean, I would have to call exceptionally, you know, offbeat considering the trajectory of a mainstream pop career, these EPs and mixtapes, it seems like she's kind of had it figured out the whole time. And maybe the apex of that was finally getting on SNL for this cycle, which I know is, you know, often people's goal because it's such a spotlight. But I don't know. I'm not convinced that like the major label has really held her back from a creative perspective.
No, I think you're right. But I also think it goes back to a point that Shad made earlier, which is that she is kind of a lovable brat. And I think that she's a workaholic. I mean, it's true. Yeah, her label has given her a lot of flexibility. And I do think that there can be a narrative sometimes that a lot of artists use when they're kind of like trapped in the system. And she has put out a lot of incredible work, despite whatever limitations that she, you know, has talked about before in terms of what her label wanted versus what she wanted. But I think she just always wants more, or she always wants to do things exactly her way. And I don't know, that's why I love her too.
Lest we forget, the lyric on Gone was originally, "I feel so unstable, hate my label."
Okay, true, possible. I don't want to be like the official Atlantic Records defender on the podcast. But, you know, when you look at her actual, you know, talking about the perception of her being huge, she doesn't have a gold album. The only thing she has that have gone gold and platinum are singles. So Boys is gold. Boom Clap is multiple times platinum. Break the Rules, even though she really didn't care for it, is gold. And she does have, since she's has a featured credit on the Icona Pop song, that is four times platinum.
her album chart history is so dismal, like how I'm feeling now. Sorry, I say dismal, like obviously charts on everything, but like for a pop star, like how I'm feeling now, 111 on the Billboard 200, Charlie 42 on the Billboard 200, like, and the like, these are records with like big marketing budgets behind them, and like it feels like whenever she releases an album, it's just like blanket, like everyone's covering it and everyone's desperate to cover every single and have her do their videos and write profiles. But it can often feel like to music critics, like she's Taylor Swift, and to everyone else, she's like, well, she was literally Taylor Swift's opener.
But I can't imagine that that causes a disconnect, and the kind of disconnect that she gets caught up in. I think, Shad, you might have referenced it a little earlier about like the quote-unquote narrative and the narrative that the fans have for her and the conversation on Twitter and on social media. She does seem more plugged into that and engaged than some other pop stars are. And I wonder how much of a hindrance that is.
I think the press has been kind to her. I think it's her fans that maybe necessarily haven't been. And you know, Shad mentioned this before, where people expect a certain kind of sound from her. And when she deviates from that at this point, fans get a little testy, or like they just didn't like the rollout for Crash. She's not a big pop star. She's not. But I think she's critically acclaimed. And I understand why critics love her and why they kind of bend over backwards to cover her work. Because I think that she makes like very great pop music, but also like intellectual pop music, and is like really pushing at the boundaries of what pop can sound like and what a pop album can look like. And for this album cycle, I think she just got a little bit in her head, and she was really paying attention to kind of the fan response to the rollout and things like that. But I think overall, like, I feel like her relationship to the press has been good, like aside from wearing that crop top that said they don't make statues of critics.
But I think her early narrative was so appealing to the press too, because she wasn't born in a lab. You know, like she really did have an organic start and she hustled. Her career did begin so long ago that there is so much to grab onto and so much to talk about with her. But I am curious, I mean, like most pop fandoms are sort of blindly loyal. I don't want to drag Lady Gaga into this, but like I'm not a fan of Chromatica. And it seemed like the fans were like completely unwilling to listen to any sort of critical discourse on it that wasn't, this is great. But Charlie's fans do sort of hold her to account in a different way.
I think you're right. And I also think it's coming through in this conversation where we all love her. But there are some albums and some songs where we're like, it's not that great. Like, I can say honestly, like, Charlie is like maybe the only artist I stand for. Like, I've been writing for her from like day one, stayed with her the whole time. But like, I can still step back and say like, oh, this isn't your best work. And I think it's because she's just really always been pushing and pushing herself. And, you know, she's such a prolific artist. Like she's had such a huge body of work, even at her age, to kind of analyze and critique. And I think people are always looking to her for what's next and like what's on the horizon, which is why Crash, I think, threw so many people off, because it was building on these retro sounds and it was interpolating like all of these classics. But I think that's why. I think it's just because people have kind of held her up as like a fortune teller in a way, or like a magic eight ball. And it's like not giving fans the answer they want. So they're like, let's just spin it around and try another response. But yeah, I think she holds herself to a high standard. And I think her fans do too.
I think she has like at times like an undeniably toxic relationship with her fans. But it's exactly as you say, Hazel. It's like people really believe in her, and weirdly a lot of stan relationships are so much about projection, and I think that's not necessarily what's happening with Charlie and her fans. Like I think a lot of fans see themselves in her, in that she's kind of like a freak in like a very normal way, like not in a way that Lady Gaga is a freak. You know, she's just kind of like someone with weird tastes and weird interests who like runs her mouth on Twitter all the time and then deletes a bunch of tweets and stuff. And I think that kind of relationship, it's much easier as a stan to be like, well, why are you making this music? Because you almost see her as a peer. Whereas like Lady Gaga, you're just kind of like, okay, Mother Monster, like do whatever the f*** you want. Like I'll buy it. You call the shots. That's like both a blessing and a curse. Like I think it must, I mean, from the sound of it, it can be really intense and awful. But I think I kind of think Charlie would probably also hate it if they were totally sycophantic. And, like, weirdly, I think being a kind of, like, lower-level pop star and having really intense sycophantic fans can lead to, like, weirdly bad music. Like, I'm thinking of the Rina Sawayama album, all her fans just being like, yes, like, this is the best music ever. And it's like, it's not. It's not very good. I don't know.
We'll have you back again for that one.
I think it's one of those things where, like, the relationship can be a bit toxic, but I think maybe it's part and parcel with her being a very unique and very special kind of pop star.
She is definitely a world builder in the way that, like, a Billie Eilish is a world builder, but she's not a superstar on the level of a Beyonce or a Taylor or, a Gaga. And I think that the idea that she does live a sort of normal life and experience things in the way that the fans do has drawn them towards her, but she also has always sort of represented and reflected a chaos. You know, like, she just is a chaotic person, and that maybe this album actually isn't all that chaotic. To me, no. It's kind of calm and clear-eyed. Mm.
Yeah, that's really, really true. Yeah.
I think we're reaching the time at which we have to wrap. So I'd love to thank Shad and Hazel for their Charlie insights. I really appreciate you both being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much.
You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. You can email us at podcast@nytimes.com. You can subscribe to Podcast at Apple, Spotify, Google, or anywhere you get your audio media. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, and somebody who is not me will be back next week. We are going to go out on Used to Know Me from the new Charlie XCX album, Crash.